Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
One of Australia's best known and most acclaimed biographers and historians, and he's written prize-winning studies on Australian Prime Ministers John Curtin and Ben Chipman. He spoke to the Sydney Institute on both of those books, and his other books include a two-volume history of the Australian Customs Service, the prize-winning history of Australia claiming a continent, and most recently Conquest, the New History of the Modern World. And he's currently working on the Australian Prime Minister Andrew Fisher. Alice Spark joined the Bureau in 1965, did a Master's in Meteorology in Pennsylvania State University, returned to Bureau in 75, took a break, rejoined in 1989, and has been involved in such areas as climate consulting, forecasting advice, including forecasting advice for the Olympic Games, and now as a senior forecaster in the Regional Forecasting Service. So our topic is
the weather report.
The weather report. We're going to lead off with David Day. And it's on the occasion of the publication of the Weather Watchers, 100 years of the Bureau of Meteorology, which has just come out in this fine volume by NUP. David, thank you.
Thank you, Derek. Thank you once again for inviting me here to address you. I won't be speaking for all that long, just 15 minutes or so, and I'll be talking, just giving an overview really of the Bureau of Meteorology, starting first with why I wrote the book, which was a bit of a change for me. I've never done anything scientific before, and in writing it I tended to shy away a bit from the science, because it wasn't meant to be a book about meteorological science. It was meant to be a book about the organisation and about Australians and the weather as well. But for me, it was also a labour of love, because my father had worked for the Bureau, you know, when I was a boy up in Charleville. He was a weather observer at the airport in Charleville. I had quite a big presence there, so I'd be out there while he was filling up the hydrogen balloons and sitting with him as he worked with his slide rule, taking down all the observations from the radio songs. And then later, my father told me not to say this, but also later playing with the balloons at birthday parties, which tended to fill the lounge room, particularly the big white ones. So, the weather then, you know, on a day like today, it's mostly about whether to take an umbrella or not, and stupidly I read the report and didn't bring my umbrella to Melbourne.
Not quite,
mate. But of course the Weather Bureau is about much more than that, and what really came forcefully home to me in writing this book was that it is about security. It is about securing our lives, and it's about securing our livelihoods as well. I want you to imagine, if you would, if we didn't have a defence force for a year. Probably most of us wouldn't notice in our daily lives. If we didn't have the Bureau for a week, people would be dying. People would be caught short without their umbrellas as well. But it would also start to affect our prosperity, because we rely incredibly in all sorts of untold ways, and ways that we don't even think about, on the Bureau. And farmers rely on the Bureau much more than they ever did in terms of planting their crops, in terms of taking their livestock in. It is very much an organisation related to the productivity of Australia, improving our productivity. So it's not just a government service. There would be no point in setting up a government department in order to tell us whether to take an umbrella to work or not. This is very much about knowing Australia's climate, which is what the organisation was established to do right at the beginning, right back in 1908. It was then set up, taken over from the state organisation, very much with security in mind. Now it's about security of aviation and other things, but back then it was largely about security of shipping. People needed to know when they got on a ship to go to New Zealand that they weren't going to be heading into a storm that would sink the ship, and ships of course regularly did sink around the Australian shore. It was also about the productivity, improving the productivity of Australia, knowing what the climate was in the different regions of Australia. It was about improving or encouraging immigration to Australia, reassuring people on the other side of the world, enjoying the lovely climate of England, that Australia wasn't all desert, that much of Australia was well watered. So if you look back at the early publications of the Bureau from the early 1900s up until the 1920s, it is largely about climate, the climate of the different regions of Australia, to try and encourage investment, to try and encourage immigration. So, and we had people like, I'll just mention some of the characters who worked for the Bureau, people like Clement Bragg, who worked for the early Queensland Bureau, and this book goes back into the 1900s, and was very fond of putting out these terrible predictions of what the weather was going to be like, and all these terrible anti-cyclones that were going to lunge up at Australia from the Antarctic. And he was also of a cheeky frame of mind. It would also give them sometimes, if he was minded to do, the names of politicians that he didn't like. So he would talk about the Deakin anti-cyclone that was coming up and was going to wreak great havoc on southeast Australia. And from those early years as well, the collection of the climate statistics depended upon volunteers. Australia still depends, the Bureau still depends, on about 7,000 volunteers around Australia who send in mostly monthly returns of their local climate, their rainfall, temperature and barometer readings. But very much from the other thing that really impressed me in writing this was that the Bureau has been run on a shoestring. Despite the importance of its functions, it has been run on a shoestring for most of its existence. And for the first 30 years or so, it was very rudimentary in the sorts of things it did and the sorts of predictions it was able to make. More often than not, or almost more often than not, it was wrong rather than right. And after the Federal Bureau was started, there were complaints in Parliament that in fact it was worse than when the states were running it. And the federal director had to admit that only 62% of the time were they right in their predictions for Adelaide. Well, you know, it's getting close to 50-50. So those sorts of predictions are not much good. The growth of the Bureau really started in the late 1930s, and like much of the Bureau history, was disaster-driven. So rather than the government of the day sort of recognising there is a problem or an opportunity and investing the Bureau with sufficient funds, it is disasters that cause the government or force the government to react. And in the 1930s there was a series of aircraft disasters, and you're probably familiar with some of them, the disaster in the Snowy Mountains where the aircraft was lost for about 30 years or so with all the people killed, and the other one up on the Lamington Plateau in Queensland. So a series of air crashes because the Bureau was simply not putting out predictions that were any good for aviators. They would tell people what the weather was at the point they were taking off from, but nothing about the weather that they were likely to encounter en route. And the Bureau at that time had very little understanding of what a cold front was. So aircraft would regularly find themselves flying smack bang into a cold front. So a series of air crashes then forced the government finally to boost the numbers in the Bureau and establish as well scientific training for meteorologists. So instead of clerks coming into the public service, being shunted off to the Bureau and told, well, man, you're a meteorologist, they started employing people from universities from about 1938. The second disaster, of course, was the Second World War, which caused a further huge boost, and thankfully that development had happened in 1938-39 to build up the Bureau so that it was ready to meet the challenge of the Second World War. But there was tremendous expansion during the Second World War as the Bureau took a leading role in ensuring the safety of various military and air operations that were carried out in this region. And of course, if we look back to Gallipoli, now, we all celebrate the success of Gallipoli, the successful evacuation of Gallipoli, but that actually came down to a meteorologist who predicted that the seas would be calm at that time. And a couple of days later, of course, they turned rough, and had the evacuation been delayed, it would almost certainly have ended in disaster. In more recent years, cyclones have also been given impetus for the development of the Bureau. When cyclones managed to cause devastation along the North Queensland coast and also in WA at various times, it forced the government to react and to install radar sets in these areas and gradually increase the radar coverage, originally starting with second-hand sets taken out of British naval ships. Which were very rudimentary, but now, of course, the sorts of radar coverage that we're used to and that we can all log on to in our homes. The Bureau and the government as well has also been driven by the great holy grail of meteorology, which, of course, for a primary producing country as Australia has been until of late, has been seasonal forecasts. To be able to tell a farmer what the next season is going to be like, to tell him whether to stock his farm or what to grow, you know, is he going to encounter a dry year or a wet year? And this has, you know, this is what caused the Bureau to establish stations down in Antarctica, because it was felt that if we knew the weather of Antarctica, we could then much more accurately predict the weather of southern Australia. But of course, that holy grail, because it is a holy grail, has always stayed elusively out of our grasp. And even though the Bureau and Ali can speak with much more confidence about this than I can, even though the Bureau now does issue seasonal forecasts, their reliability is not something probably that you would want to bet your farm on. The past director of the Bureau, in fact, was telling me that it was probably about 50-50 reliability. Well, 50-50, you might as well toss a coin, I guess. But it is getting a lot better. It is getting a lot better. There have been steady improvements in seasonal forecasting, and with the improvements in our understanding of how climate works and how the atmosphere works, and with this incredible supercomputer that the Bureau has in Melbourne, it is not beyond the bounds of possibility that within 10 years, seasonal forecasts of, you know, fair reliability will be being produced. Well, the Bureau has also been involved at various times in trying to shape the weather, in trying to actually make it rain. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we could make it rain, or on occasion stop it raining, I guess. Clement Ragg, with his association with Charleville, was one of the most prominent people, bringing back these Steiger vortex guns, like an inverted funnel that he brought back from Europe, which were used in Europe around the turn of the century, supposedly to stop hailstorms. Of course, they didn't do any such thing, but Ragg brought them back to Queensland, which was suffering a terrible drought, and set up six of them in Charleville to try and break the drought. And he set off these Steiger vortex guns on the banks of the Warrego River when some suitable clouds came over, and one of the guns immediately just exploded in smithereens. The others fired off, but to very little effect. It ruined his reputation and probably helped to convince the Bureau thereafter to be very wary about engaging in any such activity. So when the CSIRO, after the Second World War, started to become engaged in cloud seeding, the Bureau was its staunchest opponent of cloud seeding. And there's a whole other lecture one could go into about cloud seeding. But for most of the post-war years, the Bureau was forced to bite its tongue because, of course, cloud seeding had such powerful support within the farming community and also within parts of different governments. So security and productivity then remain very much at the forefront of Furoa activities today. Over the last 30 or 40 years, there have been dramatic developments in meteorology that Ali will talk about in greater detail than I will, that have allowed the Bureau to maximise its effort in those areas. And those developments have been firstly with upper atmosphere observations, suddenly finding out what was going on up there rather than simply what was going on the ground. The advent of radar after the Second World War and the steady developments of radar thereafter. You know, it's radar that allows us, our planes, that will allow my plane, hopefully, tonight to take off safely and land safely at the airport. The advent of satellites, which allowed us suddenly, one of the great problems in Australia is that there are so many areas, so much a part of Australia is unoccupied. There are no people there. There are no observations coming in. Satellites now allow us to see the inland of Australia where the Bureau is not getting observations from, and also those great ocean spaces around Australia as well. The advent of computers firstly, and then the supercomputers, which allowed the people who, I mean, what the Bureau now relies on is mathematical equations, reducing the atmosphere to mathematical equations. Ali, please talk about it in greater detail than I can, or greater authority.
That's a good talk.
Yeah, which now help to guide the forecaster in making his forecast. And lastly, the advent of automatic weather stations, so that you no longer need somebody like my father sitting out in Charleville, but you can now have an automatic weather station doing much of the work that the observers formerly did, and you can have so many more of these stations all around Australia. Well, lastly, then, I'd just like to make a plea on behalf of the Bureau, because I guess it does it privately but not publicly. As I mentioned, it has always been operating on the shoestring. My father tells a story in the late 40s when he first started after the Second World War of having to take his used pencil up to the chief clerk in order to get a new one each time, otherwise he wasn't able to get it. The Bureau did enjoy a golden age in the 1960s when all its ducks were in a row. It had a powerful director, it had a very supportive departmental secretary, and it had a very supportive minister. But that golden age gradually came to an end. And in the 1980s and 90s, the Bureau was beset with this thing called an efficiency dividend, which means a regular annual budget cutback. But is given this lovely name called an efficiency dividend. And now we hear that the present government is going to almost double this efficiency dividend so that the Bureau will be forced to operate with an even smaller budget. Now, the practical effect of this, of course, is that its services have to be cut back, and in the hope that nobody will notice. But, of course, it does make a difference to us. It does make a difference to the nation. The past director of the Bureau told me when writing this book that it was because of the budgetary difficulties that the Bureau was suffering in the late 80s and early 90s that he, as director, forewent the opportunity to give the Bureau the lead, to make the Bureau the lead organisation in tackling climate change. So had it taken that lead, had it been able, had the funds to take that lead, Australia may well have been better prepared. You know, Australia really was a laggard, and if you read the book, people were aware of what was going on back in the 1980s, but it wasn't until this century that something serious started to be done about it. So it's more than ever important, I would argue, and I'm not a paid servant of the Bureau, more than ever important, that the Bureau's vital functions of security and enhancing our productivity and prosperity be both acknowledged and enhanced. So thank you.
Good evening. I'm delighted to be here tonight. When the invitation for me to come along... The reasons I was given was because I was at the other sex, was involved in the Sydney Olympics, and was a forecaster in Sydney. So I thought I'd talk to you about the changes in those three subjects since I've joined the Bureau. The first one is the role of women. The first female meteorologist in the Bureau was Barbara Daniel. She started her active forecasting career in 1962, which is not that long before I joined. Subsequently, Rosie Boyd and Margaret Amos started forecasting in 1963. And all of these ladies were taught their observing skills by Alan Fowler. So then the book shows a photo in 1965 in which there were 8 women out of 23. I think that was probably a high point for a long time. The Bureau was dominated by men for a long, long time. And until 1966, women employed in the Bureau, and for that matter any of the Commonwealth Public Service, if you became married, you simultaneously became unemployed. No married women in the Commonwealth Public Service, which is quite amazing when you think about it now. It took until 1972 as well before the Australian Public Service granted equal pay for equal work. In recent times, women in the Bureau have increased dramatically, and if we just look at forecasting, forecasters on the forecasting course, 30 to 50% levels of women, with a total of 44% of women, new women meteorologists during the last 5 years. This has had the effect that now there are many more women in the Bureau. We regularly have forecasting shifts which are all women. That would be 4 or 5 women on shift at the same time. And not so long ago, 1995, I think. August 2005, we had the first time that we had all women at chart discussion, 7 of us. And we marked that with photo. And in the Northern Territory, they currently have 10 women forecasters out of a total of 21. So it's quite a change in demographic, and the office itself feels different, clearly, if you're one woman amongst all men. So it's quite a change there. Secondly, the Sydney Olympics. I was quite privileged to be appointed manager of the Bureau's forecasting projects for the Olympics. This gave me the opportunity to go to the United States in 1995 and 96 to observe what the Americans were doing for their Atlanta Olympics, and with that I was trained there, and I also took part in the forecasting. And I came away with the determination that we would do as well and if possibly better for the Sydney 2000 Olympics. So we copied as much as we could from the Americans, and we made changes where we thought it would improve things. We invited from each Bureau forecasting office around the country to send 2 of their best forecasters to take part in the forecasting efforts, and the result was an outstanding forecasting service, as well as valuable learning experience and exchange of ideas between all these forecasters. The most significant difference between us and the Americans was that our public internet output included all the live forecasts and observations, whereas the US they only had climatology available on the internet. Now, that's fundamentally due to the difference in those 4 years between the change of the internet, both the usage by the people as well as the technology that was behind it. The Olympic Forecasting Project was instrumental in generating a number of firsts for the Bureau. It was the first time that radar loops were made freely available to the public. Before that, we had radar loops internally, and we had radar loops available by registered user, but not anybody could log on. And I fought long and hard to get them available to everybody. And since then, the Bureau decided to make it generally available, and it's taken off like a rocket. And it's the flagship of the increased popularity of the Bureau's website. If you look on page 456 of the Weather's Watchers, there's a book there, there's a graph that shows the increased usage of internet use, and it sort of starts in 2000 and grew from there at an astronomical rate. Second significant output was the provision of on-site forecasting and briefing at the Olympic and SOCOP headquarters. We discovered that forecasts were perceived to be better if we updated them more often. And also we found out that forecasts could be useful even if they were wrong, provided you were talking to your client and they understood that there could be an alternative scenario. They could plan for the alternatives. Now this is not something we currently apply on a large scale basis because our forecasts are categoric and they go out in black and white. It's either going to rain or it's not going to rain. But there has been an increase in briefing services available to parts of the aviation industry, and we regularly have staff available at New South Wales Bushfire Services headquarters during major fires. And this personal contact between forecasters and clients is very, it's very good and very important. You really get your message across. It's one reason we like to talk on the ABC, on the Country Hour and local radio, because we actually get to explain what we're doing. Now, what about some of the changes in meteorological sciences and technology since I first started actually forecasting in 1972? What has stayed the same since then, and in fact since the early parts of the century, is the basic physics which is fundamental to the overall motion of the atmosphere. That hasn't changed. If you read the textbooks from then, the equations are still the same to the ones that we use today. What has changed is our understanding of phenomena such as tropical cyclones, thunderstorms and tornadoes. And what has changed absolutely beyond recognition are the technological changes, which have allowed the development of radar technology, lightning detection, fast delivery, satellite information, web information, and numerical weather prediction. The possibility of the latter was first postulated by Lewis Richardson in 1911 in England. And we quote, "Perhaps someday, in the dim future, it will be possible to advance the computations faster than the weather advances, and at a cost less than the savings to mankind due to the information gained. But that is a dream." When I started forecasting in 72, all weather maps and upper air charts were plotted by hand and analysed by hand. Vertical soundings of the atmosphere were available then as now. We even used the same forms to aid in the forecasting of planar weather. But future projections of these were done manually through extrapolation of the upper and surface systems. Satellite information was available, but it only came into the office once a day. On a system was exceedingly slow. It used to take 40 minutes to deliver one photo and had very low resolution. You either had brown or white, there were no shades of grey in between. A very basic numerical weather prediction model known as the Barrett Clinic model was run on an IBM 360 machine in Melbourne. I now have more power on my desktop. And this provided 24-hour forecast maps. But in addition, we still did prognostic weather charts by moving the changes in the 24 and 6 hourly isobars of the barometric pressure graphically on a hand and creating new charts from the new charts. We only did 24 hour forecasts, except for twice a week we did a 4-day outlook from Mondays and Thursdays for the Sydney region. All forecasts were typed on a typewriter and subsequently retyped and sent on paper tape by telex. Small weather maps were hand-copied from the big charts and made available to the newspapers, and they also went on the daily bulletin board here at the GPO. I don't know if any of you remember that. You used to be able to go and see the weather for the day at the GPO. The first PC and NEC was introduced into the Sydney office in 1984. By 1989, when I returned to the Bureau, it was the proud user of an interactive computer display system called Macitus, and we're still using that today, and a computerised forecast dissemination system known as AROS. This meant no more typewriters or telex. The forecast went directly from the forecaster to the user. A computer model known as the Australian Regional Assimilation and Prediction System was in place, and that delivered forecast charts at multiple levels in the atmosphere out to 48 days. And an extended outlook system was available based on long wave patterns. There was an increased understanding of the physics of thunderstorms, largely due to the radar-based observations. I remember when I first came back, there was a series of lectures by Charles Doswell, an American gentleman, about thunderstorms and supercells and some of the things that I never knew about before. Since then, computer power has increased exponentially, and meteorologists have stayed at the forefront in using the newest and the fastest computers as they were built. Satellite derived winds and temperatures became available, and these are now used as numerical model input. Computer models, and you can find them on the web freely available, now deliver forecast charts well out beyond 7 days. For day 7 and beyond, I don't think the verification is very good, but at 4 days out, our forecasts are now as good as they were for 1 day not that long ago. In Australia, we now have direct computer access to the output of some of the world's best forecasting models, although at very high resolution, we still use our own. Some of these are also freely available on the web, and systems are available which combine the output of a number of these and there's an increase in skill in combination of temperatures and rainfall. I now sit in front of a number of workstations and PCs. I have a total of 7 screens in front of me with multicoloured information running on different workspaces, and that allows me to visualise what's happening in the atmosphere. However, I still type my forecasts by hand. The technological changes have invariably accompanied by hypotheses on the part of somebody in authority that forecasting can be done with fewer personnel. My observations, and I haven't got any numbers to back this up, would indicate that this is rarely the case. As our ability to deliver increases, our expectations, and yours also, increase. We attempt to forecast for more places, at finer resolutions and in more detail. And to do so we need more radars, better access to the world's best computer of models, and more staff. One of the worries about getting the more radars we want is that you're going to need more people to look at them, because there's not much point having them unless you can actually have the staff to do something with them. So what's the future? The Bureau is currently looking at 2 major changes to the way we forecast. The first is collaboration with the UK Meteorological Office in combining their extremely good global model with a local version, local high resolution version. The second involves the graphical manipulation of model output coupled with automatic text generation and interactive web displays. So in theory, no more typing. This type of system is currently used by the United States National Weather Service, amongst others, and the Bureau of Meteorology is trialling an adaptation of the United States system. When implemented, this should permit a hugely expanded weather forecast delivery system via the internet. It'll mean, you know, you live at Gosford, click on Gosford, you get a Gosford forecast. Click on West Wyalong, you get a West Wyalong forecast. You can currently go to the US Weather Bureau site, and you can do that for the United States. So that's the past and the future to come. That's it.
Thank you. So we come to questions and discussion. Lieutenant Grundy from next chapter of the books has got some copies of David Day's The Weather Watchers, with a nice chart inside about total rainfall over Australia since 1900. David was telling me earlier that there was a Royal Commission into Sydney Water Supply in 1902 because water was running out, but it was resolved in the same way, rain. So questions, you might just come up here, you folks. We'll have to start with David. Now, yes, David, both you and Ellie at the end spoke a bit about support for the Bureau, and you were talking about the Bureau being caught up in the federal government's cutbacks, which should be announced in the budget. Has the Bureau had any kind of political support? I mean, has it been supported by the National Party because of its rural connections, or is it sort of something outside of politics? Because as you know, some of these organisations have had political support, others haven't. Where's the Bureau fit in that?
Well, in the Second World War, after the Second World War, it's mostly been a conservative government that's been in charge, and it has had support from people like Peter Nixon and Doug Anthony in particular, when he was the relevant minister, was very supportive of the Bureau. But as too was Barry Jones, and you know, as science minister, he was appalled at the state of the science of the Bureau, the sort of equipment that it was forced to deal with or forced to use in the 1980s, and he famously sort of held up one of these Second World War valves that came out of a Bureau radar set in Parliament to try and highlight to his colleagues, as much as anyone, the state of the Bureau. But it's largely been a matter of the Bureau, you know, trying to argue its case with Treasury. It's also the Bureau for a while was helped by having an advisory committee, and it sensibly got people like the editor of The Australian on board and some high-powered businessmen as well, who became powerful advocates for the Bureau. But unfortunately, that committee was ended, I think, in the early 1990s. So it's largely been sort of back doors arguing, back corridor arguing that the Bureau's relied upon.
Just to go beyond that, for both of you, listening to the way you've described the need for weather reporting, is it a marketable commodity in any way? I mean, we talk about privatising all sorts of things. Mm-hmm. I don't mean privatising, but are there products within meteorological predictions that are of such importance that if you don't have them, companies are prepared to pay for them? I mean, can you sell yourself?
David, just talk to the back of the room.
Yeah, well, companies do sell themselves. There are private organisations that have been set up to sell meteorological information. But the Bureau has always been very wary of it, and it's been under pressure from successive governments to become more involved, you know, to get revenue in. And, of course, it could. I mean, it could charge everybody, you know, instead of people being able freely to look up on the internet what the weather's like, it could charge people. But when it's tried to do it, and it tried to do it with recorded telephone messages in the 1980s, I think, you know, to earn 50 cents or 40 cents or whatever it was at the time. But this is people in Queensland, you know, ringing up to find out about the cyclone, and they felt really, you know, there was an uproar in Queensland, as you might expect. And that plan was dropped. So they have a small section within the Bureau that does do commercial activities, but they keep them very separately, rigidly separate from the public activities, which have to be done with the public need in mind. And there have been problems in the past where commercial organisations have competed with the Bureau and given out forecasts that conflict with Bureau forecasts, which causes all sorts of confusion. And in one notorious case in the Northern Territory, it caused an oil rig to be evacuated and closed down for some days because they gave out a forecast that it was going to be hit by a cyclone, and the Bureau was saying, well, no, the cyclone's not coming anywhere near you, which of course it didn't. Mm.
Ellie, do you
want
to
add
to
that? Well, I guess just, I mean, there are commercial meteorologists
in Australia these days that provide a specialised service to companies. Like you said, the Bureau does some of it. But the Bureau's fundamental role in providing the forecasts in the morning, gathering data, is something that, you know, like you said, I mean, how do you charge people for data that we gather? It's something that's part of the Constitution. I think very properly is part of the Bureau. We need to do it as well as we can, and we need to be funded for it.
The other big problem with it is, of course, that the whole international meteorological system relies upon the free flow of data. And once you start putting a price on that data, the whole system collapses.
Yes. You mentioned that Australia is, like most nations, is becoming a heavy user of satellite images of weather patterns. And yet it's well known that this nation doesn't own any weather satellites and barely owns any satellites of any type at all. I had a question for both of you. To what extent are we still dependent upon the charity of other nations to supply us with this data, and how tenuous is that link?
Absolutely. Courtesy of the Japanese, the Americans, and now to some extent the Chinese, who do have weather satellites up there, and they share their data, it's freely available. Not only the weather satellites, every single observation that goes into our numerical weather prediction models, it's all based on global models, and what goes into global models is global data. It's global data gathered by observers on the ground, and it's the biggest free sharing of anything in the whole world. It's tremendous. And, you know, whether you're a little country or a big country, everybody uses it.
And these satellite providers get our data in return as well. So, you know, it's not just charity.
Yeah. It's quick pro quo.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we get much more back.
We get more back.
You know, putting up satellites is very
expensive. Down the back.
You mentioned something about pleading. You said the word pleading. Well, we should have noted pleading. Would you reiterate on that point? And has it got something to do with the government reducing funding for the department or something like that? What was the point about the pleading that you had?
Well, what I was saying was that since the 1980s, with economic rationalism partly, there has been this introduction of a so-called efficiency dividend, which requires departments to reduce their spending by 1.5% every year. So of course, if you take that logically to its conclusion, they end up with nothing. So they're forced to do each year, but of course, as Ali said, they're forced to do more each year, but given less with which to do it with. So the numbers of staff in the Bureau have almost halved, I think, since the 1960s. And the only way they get new money is by putting in, you know, having a new project, by saying, well, we'll have these automatic weather stations, and the Treasury will agree to automatic weather stations, but they won't agree to the staff to actually maintain them. So at one stage off the Kimberley coast, we had this crazy situation of the radar station out of order and the two automatic weather stations off the coast also out of order, just as the cyclone season was approaching, because the Bureau budget couldn't extend itself to actually send in people out to maintain these automatic weather stations, which are regularly vandalised by visiting Indonesian fishermen.
This is more about weather that we've been experiencing recently, and with Australia, it's just been in the grips of an enormous drought. Do you believe it's due to climate change and global warming, or do you believe it was just a natural phenomenon and now the rain?
Yeah, well, if you have a look in the front, inside the front cover of the book, you'll see the last 100 years of Australia's climate. And Australia is, the world is marked by climate change. It's a feature of our lives. It's a constant feature of our lives. But it certainly is true now that part of that climate change is due to human activity. And increasingly, so we are told, you know, a large proportion of that change is due to human activity. But I do get wary when I see some of the more scary pronouncements by certain people who will remain nameless, talking about Perth being the first modern city to be abandoned and all this sort of rubbish, and this being the worst drought that we've ever seen, which is just, in my view, a load of rubbish. Because if you look at those special funds, those special accounts that farmers are allowed to draw on in hard times, they've hardly been touched.
How do you want to add to that? You don't have to.
Well, I can to some extent.
Okay.
I mean, the droughts that we've been seeing are part of climate variability, which we've known since the Federation drought, when people still first started looking at climate. And, when we're talking about climate change, that's something else again. You're looking at a slow change on which this other bigger variation sits on top. So one doesn't exclude the other.
Question here.
Well, I mean, I must say, when I came to Sydney 50 years ago, the weather was exactly like it's been this last week. You know, great rain falling on you. And when I was a child in Melbourne, you know, we had bushfires and we had great heat, it seemed exactly like what it always is. But I don't mean that it doesn't mean that it's no possibility of climate change. But on the other hand, what has happened about this understanding of El Niño and La Niña? Has that become something that has recently come into the consciousness of people and it's a dip on our weather? How important is that knowledge of the Pacific, of the current
zone? It's very important. I think it's probably since about the late 1980s. 1980s people started to talk about it. Since I returned in 1989, people were getting excited about it in the early 90s. And the whole understanding that our rainfall patterns are driven by the oceans, which is what the El Niño La Niña is about, and that there can be a switch in the temperatures or the anomalies in the temperatures in the ocean, which results in a switch in whether you have a drought or a flood. And that's too categoric, because it's one of the ways that's misunderstood, because you're only talking probabilities. It's a probability of a drought or a probability of weather conditions. That's been added upon and added upon since the early 90s, and people are still finding more about that at the moment. At the moment, one of the things they're talking about is the influence of the Indian Ocean variation in the water temperatures, as well as the variations in the Pacific Ocean, and the two adding together. So there's constant more information about it in terms of what's driving our droughts and our wetter periods.
Question there.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Sorry, I was going to ask the same question about these two Harry Potter's characters, El Niño and La Niña. What progress are you making with the study? It seems that the recent rainfall has been attributed to El Niño suddenly appearing off the coast.
La Niña
was aware of that. Perhaps you wouldn't have a desalination plant. But what progress are you making with this simply characters in quite out of fiction, rather than radio sampling and atmospheric measurements and digital radar? Suddenly these strange characters have appeared over the ocean. Are we getting any further to understanding what they're about predicting them?
To some extent, people running computer models that apparently seem to be showing some skill in that, but I have to tread very warily. It's not my area of expertise at the moment. I'm a forecaster. I do try and keep up to date. I think there is still a predictability barrier in autumn. Once you've got a El Niño or La Niña, we're pretty confident in saying, you know, the probabilities for the next so many months are such and such. But at certain times of the year, it's very difficult. The computer guided, not the statistical models, but the deterministic models, I believe are getting better. Sorry, statistical ones for that matter. But you're still not at a stage where, you know, if you play the odds over a number of years, a farmer can come ahead. But if you, you know, put your house on the predictions for 1 year, if you've got even if it's a 70% chance, there's still a 30% chance of it going the other way.
Just a question,
yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm wondering if the Bureau systematically or occasionally assesses its track record of accuracy.
Yeah.
And whether it makes that data available to the public as well.
Oh, yes, we do. There is, I'm sure that there is information available to the public. The problem is, how long is a piece of string? How do you define what you're actually measuring? What's easy to measure is how good the forecasting models are. They define a skill score, and you can assess them on the basis of skill score. You can assess in terms of rainfall, how often you get it right within categories, and it does that all the time. But the other day I made a forecast of rain increasing overnight. Showers increasing overnight, rain or showers in the morning, decreasing in the afternoon. Now, can you measure that?
Were you right?
I was right.
100%.
Otherwise, I wouldn't have told you. But you know, on some occasions, that's stretching the limits of our knowledge. I could easily have been wrong. But, you know, I guess I thought I had a fair chance of being right. I don't know if the next forecast I had the guts to stick with that forecast. It would have been much easier just to say showers, pray straight out, which is what ended up going on the praise heap, but that's all you can put on the praise heap. Temperatures are easy to verify. With temperatures, I guess the questions are, at what stage do you call it a hit? Is a temperature forecast of 20 a hit at 20? Is it a hit at anything between 19 to 21? They did a survey in Canada a while ago. Apparently the Canadians were quite happy to have anything forecast within 4 degrees as being a hit.
Well, it was
Canada. You know, what's right? Question mark.
Is it minus 10?
Minus 15? Definitely better.
I have probably a trivial question, but recreational boating, there used to be a number you could ring to get a Sydney boating weather forecast, telephone number. It was listed in the, you know, the telephone calls. I think it's been, hasn't been around for years.
Yeah.
I believe. I think it has.
Efficiency dividend.
Yeah, I can't answer you. I noticed Julie sitting in the audience over there. She might know the answer to that one.
The question is, why can't you ring up the Weather Bureau and get a boating forecast anymore?
On the phone.
On the phone.
Has to change the number.
What was the answer? You can.
It's obviously got
to
be a number. What's the number?
What's the number? I'm so straight, the first thing I'm going to do. Yeah.
What's the number?
What's the number? Anyway, there you go. You can fix him with the number. And there's a question here.
Without wishing to be pedantic, could you explain the term meteorology? I don't know what meteors have got to do with.
Okay.
We have a few pins here.
meteors are things that fall out of the sky. Hydro meteors is rain. I think that's the comment. Yeah, that's where it came from. Thank you. Sorry.
Just a final question.
Okay.
Go on.
I was going to say, I'm not 100% sure that's correct, but I think it is.
Final question to David. Your father's still alive, right?
Yes.
So, just tell us a bit about the book. I mean, there's a huge amount of work in this book. I mean, there are lots of footnotes. So, how long did it take you to do it, and what does your father think about it? Because he gets a mention as this, Ellen, isn't it? He gets a mention as having told you something about a pencil in 2005, but otherwise you wouldn't know whose father he was. So, what's the old man think?
Did he get a new pencil? Did they give him a new one?
He's very happy, man. As far as I know, he's very happy with the book.
Did he get a photograph? Did he photograph me?
No.
Pretty cruel.
Well, you have a choice when you write a commissioned history like this of mentioning everyone, and having a huge index of names of everybody who's involved. But it tends then to be just a series of anecdotes. And it's of interest to the people within the organisation, but of no interest to anybody outside of it, because you have no idea who these people are, and you couldn't care less, because the anecdotes are usually fairly meaningless. So I was very intent on writing a book that would be meaningful to people outside of the Bureau, that would be meaningful to people, to ordinary Australians who use the Bureau's services. And at the same time being meaningful to people in the Bureau, to try and give them a wider picture of the organisation with which they've been involved, and also to try and record the organisation's history so that it is now, you know, down on paper. And the Bureau, as well, to its credit, has a series of historical papers that it publishes as well. So this isn't the only sort of Bureau history. And, you know, some people would take issue with it that I don't mention radars enough. I didn't mention this particular radar set or whatever. Or I didn't mention a particular person who played a distinguished role. But, you know, that's the price you pay when you paint with a broad brush.
Many thanks. Well, it was a great night tonight. I learned a lot, and I didn't think I'd be interested in the Bureau that I was.
Terrific, David. Success there.
I'm taking
Colin. Are you going to come
on? Colin, yeah. Well, I'll try and give it a plug somehow. But thanks to David for his historical work, and thanks, Riley, for bringing us up to date about what goes on in your organisation. So both papers will be published in the Sydney papers. They'll be up on our podcast, and I'm sure the night will live on. But for now, thanks to both our speakers, and their copies of David's book outside. So well done, David, and well done, Riley. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.